This is the Blue Moose podcast with me, Lucy McNamara. This month, Blue Moose publishes Anna Chilver's novel, Tainted Love.
Tainted Love is set in a town, she's sort of like a West Yorkshire town set in the hills, where I guess all the characters are a little bit larger than life, and sometimes that larger than life moves beyond sort of the life that we normally understand. So characters actually have sort of properties and characteristics which are above, beyond human. So it's a story about people and families and a mother who's missing who comes back, and it's about relationships and mother and daughter relationships, mother and son relationships.
When I started the book, mm-hmm. I actually had sort of no idea that it was about sort of turn into cross between Twilight and Happy Valley. You know, it was like this kind of suddenly this vampire situation within a place like Hebden Bridge, you know. Yeah. That really grabbed me. It becomes part fantasy, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could call it fantasy. I mean, I think it's very grounded in reality, so I'd probably go more along with magic realism than fantasy, because it is set within a very much a real world where sort of normal things happen in an everyday way, but then there's the magic amongst the real. And I think that's what I wanted to create, a world that's sort of like we recognise, but with these magic elements in it, rather than this completely other fantastical world which you tend to get in a fantasy novel. So it's fantastical in parts.
So where did the idea come from then?
I mean, I got a lot of the idea for the plot from song lyrics. There's songs threaded through the book. One of the characters is a DJ, and at the end of the book there's a playlist. But when I was writing it, a lot of the plot ideas came from the song lyrics. They're mostly sort of Northern Soul, Motown type songs. And I think a lot of those sort of songs just express real things about the human condition, about the sorrow of losing somebody, or the pain of being on your own, or jealousy. All those sort of very human emotions are there, just there in the songs, and it's very easy to take them out. And at one point, I used to listen to the songs as I was writing, or before I started writing, to get me in the mood. But also at one point, a lot of the chapters had song titles as headings. And that sort of changed as I wrote it, and the book grew and went in different directions. So the songs didn't stay attached to the chapters right the way through to the end. There are other places the ideas came from as well. I mean, there are some sort of local legends that have been woven into the book, some things that either really happened or are said to have really happened in this area. And also, I mean, you've mentioned that there are vampires in it. I kind of wanted to write a vampire book. I've always enjoyed them. So there was that as well. So there's all these different things coming together. But the songs are very much, you know, sort of the base of that.
And how did you manage to kind of amalgamate in your mind the setting, if you like, and the fact that you're going into fantasy and vampires and things like that? Was it fairly easy for you?
I'm very sort of familiar with the landscape. I think it seemed fairly natural to just sort of bring those things in. I mean, I think the landscape here is full of secrets. There are valleys and there are hidden places, and there's always something different around the corner that you're not expecting. And to get magic into that landscape, I think, is not that big a step, really.
When I read the book, all I could see really was Hebden Bridge and Cragvell, and you know, that sort of area. And but for people perhaps who don't know the area, perhaps describe what this area is like and what the book tells them.
Okay, well, the area is, it's got very steep valleys. I think I mentioned somewhere in the book it's sort of like God scrunched it up and threw it into a ball, and it's sort of like that. It's got deep valleys and steep hills. It rains a lot, so everything's very green. But then up on the top, there's the moors. So you've got a real contrast between that windswept top bit. When you get up to the tops, there's heather and wind. And then these sort of very tight valleys, these very sharp valleys that are full of green and water and secrets. And I think that's really lends itself to storytelling, I think.
And the characterisation for me in this particular book, there's just so many levels to these characters. You talked about the DJ, and that is Mr. Lyon, isn't
it? Yes, it is.
And he was one of my favourite characters, along with Peter and along with Lauren. I liked Lauren a lot. And Jimmy as well.
Yeah.
And I want to just go through how you got those characters together, how they came alive, really.
Some of it came from songs. So, I mean, the first song on the playlist at the end of my book is Shy Guy by The Uptights, and Peter kind of came from that. He is half goat, so he's a bit different. And I think I wanted to play with that idea that everybody has got their differences. You know, there is no such thing as a normal person. Everybody's got something strange about them. And so the characters in my book have just made those strangenesses more. So their strangenesses are quite unhuman. Peter was asleep, curled up at the back of the cave, his child legs tucked underneath him, his chin touching his knees. His dad crouched beside him and smoothed the hair back from his face. Peter moved his shoulder and twitched cheek muscle. His face was streaked with tears. His dad covered him with a blanket, then set about building up the fire. He put a pan of stew on the stove. When it was bubbling and the savoury herb smells wafted through the cave, Peter woke and came and sat by the fire, the blanket still around his shoulders. His dad gave him a bowl of stew and a hunk of Mr. Lion's caraway bread. They ate in silence and watched the flames. Peter was hungry. He wiped the bowl clean with the last crust of bread and leaned against his dad. "All right, son." "Okay," he said quietly. "Things getting to you." His dad put his arm around him and poked at the fire with his hoof. Sparks flew up and landed in their coats. "Why are we like this?" Peter said. "Like this?" His dad crushed a spark that had begun to smoulder. "Yes, and why do we live in a cave? And why don't we feel cold like other people? And why do you have horns on your head? And why haven't I?" He was defiant and angry, and his eyes shone in the firelight. His dad touched the hair on his head. "You will have horns one day when you're older." "Like yours?" "Yes, like mine." "And will I be able to run like you?" "Yes, we can run together." He nodded and sat quiet. "More stew?" Peter shook his head. "But Dad, people laugh at me. Why can't I be like everyone else?" "Who do you want to be like? Like Mr. Lion? Like Jimmy, who can eat fire? Like Lauren, who can hear the plants talking?" "Just normal. Like Joel Weatherby? Like the other boys at school? Is that what you want? Do you want to live in a house with doors and the television?" Peter looked up at the sky. The first star had just appeared. "Venus," he whispered. They sat and watched her, and she winked at them. Jimmy is the sweet-talking guy from another song. And Mr. Lion is probably the person in Tainted Love, the song, which my book, the version, is the Gloria Jones version. Sometimes I feel I've got to run away, I've got to get away from the pain you drive into the heart. And there's a lot of sort of circusy stuff around here as well, so it's not a big step to create characters, I think.
And with Lauren and Peter's relationship, how did you sort of get around that thing where some people might go, a goat, half goat boy and a normal girl? This is, you know, because it gets quite sort of, they have a relationship, don't they?
They do.
And it, yeah. You know, so how did you sort of deal with that and how did you sort of tackle that, really?
I don't know. I mean, I think Peter, it never says in the book, but I imagine Peter's dad, who is a character in the book as well, is Pan. And he is the god of sex, he is life. And so Peter is his son. So it's not that huge a step to move to that, I think.
In the end, you forget that, you don't forget Peter's half-goat. It becomes less important. It's funny, actually, that I've picked out all the sort of very lovely characters, isn't it? I've not really gone near, is it Meg, who's the one that sort of turns quite vicious at the end, doesn't she?
She does. I've sort of got a soft spot for Meg, though. I mean, she does some bad stuff in the book, but I don't think she's completely evil. She's just like a lot of people out. She wants to be happy.
We've sort of talked about characters dealing with social problems because you've said the characters you know, no one's perfect. And it did feel that we were also dealing with kind of social problems. You know, the problems that Peter was getting at school with being different. And, and Lauren was obviously is very popular and very beautiful. And so it was much more accepted. So talk us through some of those problems.
Peter is obviously different. He's got hooves instead of feet and he's half goat. So he gets teased and bullied at school to an extent. But also he has to learn to be himself within that. He tries to hide that for a while. There are, I mean, at the very beginning of the book, it talks about him wearing shoes and a hat and clothes to sort of hide who he is and to just seem to make himself look like an ordinary boy. And I guess part of the book is about the process of going from that place where you want to fit in, where you want to be like everybody else, to accepting the fact that you're not like everybody else and who you are and to celebrate those differences. And I guess that Peter is, his journey is, shows that very clearly, but I think all the characters are doing that to a certain extent. And Lauren does fit in at school. She is blonde and pretty and, you know, the centre of a crowd, but also she's got her other things about her that are different. She can hear plants speaking. Her home life is quite unusual. She's been brought up by her father, but also Mr. Lion, and her mother has not been there all her life. So although she seems very normal, she's got things about her that are unresolved, and she also has to come to terms with the person she is. And I think that's true for everybody in the book, even the vampires. It's to do with self-acceptance and not hiding those differences, but celebrating those differences. So I guess that's definitely a theme going through the book.
And let's talk about the vampires, because obviously you take them through history, because vampires don't die. So we see them in times before, and that can take them out of the area of, we hear about them in Paris and various other areas.
Yeah.
How did you do your research for that?
Well, I've been to Paris, so it's not too difficult. I mean, and there's an extra trip to Paris is always a good idea. Research, it's one of the great things about writing. You choose somewhere to set your novel and then you have to go on a research trip, so that's brilliant. Some of the things that happen in history with the, in the vampire story, I mean, I got things from old newspapers. I mean, they are sort of from this area, but there's a story in there of three boys that drowned, and that is a real story that happened. Three boys really did drown at that reservoir, so that's an actual story that I've taken and woven into the story in 1889, I think it was. There's a monument in the book which is Studley Pike, and the story about a child who gets wounded by a sword at the opening ceremony, which is something actually happened at the opening ceremony for Studley Pike. So yes, so I've taken some real stories of stuff that happened and woven that into my characters' stories. And then the sort of wider history, a sort of more world history, it's, I think it's taking things that I know of the world and fitting it in where it fits with my story, really. The sort of history of the mills, and one of the characters' fathers dies working in the mill, and that is based very much on this area and the way it was at the, during the Industrial Revolution. And I think that's another theme of the book, which is to do with location, is that this area has changed a lot during the time that the vampires, in vampires' lifetime of my book, this area has changed from somewhere that was very industrial to somewhere that isn't. And part of it is to do with that cycle of nature, that we, whatever we do to the landscape, nature will come back and take it back in the end.
We've talked a lot about, you know, the book, and now I'd quite like to talk about you as an author. Do you have any other genres that you like reading?
Yeah, I like reading every genre. I mean, I don't think I read widely. I read everything. I wouldn't say there are genres that I wouldn't read. I think I would read most things. Depends what mood I'm in. I mean, if I'm just wanting to sort of relax and curl up, you know, sort of in a sort of escapist type way with a book, I might read crime novels or different things. But then in another mood, I'd read something very different, and I enjoy everything, really.
In terms of how you write, writers write in very different ways. Some sort of lock themselves away for days on end. I mean, how do you tackle writing a novel?
Well, I have to tackle it in conjunction with the rest of my life. I haven't really got the opportunity to lock myself away and write a whole novel. I have to do other things as well. I've got family and I do other work, so it has to fit around all those things. I find I go through phases where I sort of write a lot, and then another phase where I find I don't write so much, and it goes through cycles. And when I'm in a sort of writing mood, I usually write very early in the morning, so I often get up really early and get quite a chunk of writing done before the rest of the things I've been doing in the day get going. And I might continue doing that for a period of weeks or months and create quite a lot of work. And then I might have another few weeks or months where I don't do that and I might do more editing or research or other things. So it does tend to go in chunks. And that used to worry me when you get to the phase where you're not writing loads every day. I used to get really worried and think I can't write anymore. But I'm learning that it does go in cycles, and if I'm in that place, then I will come back to the full-on writing bit
and
at some point.
How do you motivate yourself to get up?
One of my favourite quotes was, I think it was from Anthony Burgess. He said that he only ever writes when he's inspired, and he makes sure that he's inspired every morning at 9 o'clock when he sits down at his desk. And I think that's what you have to do. You just have to sit down and you have to do it. Because if you sort of wait for this sort of flash of inspiration to come, you might be waiting forever. And I find that some days you feel like you've really been on fire and you've really written loads of really good stuff. And then when you come back and look at it another time, it maybe isn't. And other days when it feels like you're pulling teeth and it's really hard, you think, oh, this is really not going well, you come back and you've actually written some really good stuff. So it can work both ways. So I think you just have to sit down and do it. Apply the seat of your pants to the seat of your chair, I think, as somebody else said.
Yeah. What challenges did you face with this novel?
I think because a lot of the plots came from songs and they were separate songs, it's weaving those together. I mean, I could have written a collection of short stories, which each one was based on a separate song. But I chose not to do that. So I guess it was bringing those stories together to weave them as a whole. So it is all one whole novel rather than lots of separate stories. And I hope I've managed to do that so it doesn't just seem like short stories knitted together. But I guess that was a challenge, certainly in the early planning stages, that how I'd bring all these different threads together to become one thing.
Brilliant. And also Blue Moose, obviously, you know, you've chosen Blue Moose and they've chosen you, you work together. Why have you chosen sort of an independent, and what do you think are the great things about an independent publishing house?
Well, I think independent publishers have got a different sort of agenda. I think the big publishers, their agenda is what will make the most money. How they can sell the most. Well, obviously, independent publishers do want to sell their books, but I think they are able and do make have a closer relationship with their writers, and they think they're able to look more for sort of things that excite them rather than what will fit with what was out last year, you know, following trends, and they can start trends. And I mean, Blue Moose, Kevin at Blue Moose, he's brilliant. He throws everything at every book that comes out. He's really behind it. He's really passionate about what he does. And every book that he brings out, he really believes in, and he really puts himself behind it and supports his authors right the way down the line, which I think a big publisher, they just aren't able to do that because they're not able to make that personal relationship with the authors.
So that was Anna Chilvers talking to me about her book Tainted Love. Anna will read again from the book at the end of the podcast. But first, let's meet one half of Blue Moose, Kevin Duffy, who's been running Blue Moose since 2006 with his wife, Heather. So tell us from the beginning then how Blue Moose started.
It was set up kind of bile and anger, really. I'd won a national writing competition from a big Sunday newspaper and was whisked down to London to be wine and dine at the Ivy. There was the editorial director from Macmillan and an Uber agent from Curtis Brown. Got the agent's name wrong. It was a double barrel name. I mispronounced it, and she took great slight at this and didn't really speak to me for the rest of the 2 hours, so I just had far too much to drink. Ruby Wax was on the next table being loud and American, so knowing that I'd never come back to such a swanky restaurant again, I decided to steal a face cloth from the toilets. And as I was doing so, I got a tap on the shoulder, turned round, and there was a wardrobe-sized man saying that, "We don't do that, do we, sir?" So I was in imminent danger of being thrown out of the restaurant. Talked my way back in, but it didn't go that well, and they didn't want my book. A year later, I'd seen in the bookseller all the money was going to, all the big money for new advances was going to Irish writers. So I changed my name to Colm O'Driscoll and sent the first three chapters off to an agent in London called Darley Anderson. And he tried to ring me, but obviously Colm O'Driscoll didn't exist in the telephone book in Hebden Bridge, Collingwood Driscoll didn't exist, only in my imagination. So he wrote me a letter, and I phoned him back, but of course I had to be Irish, and I had to be Irish for 12 months, even lying to my two sons. This is how desperate writers are to get published. I lied to my son saying that if a posh man from London rings up and asks to speak to Colm O'Driscoll, Colm O'Driscoll is your dad. Your dad isn't Kevin Duffy, it's Colm O'Driscoll. Anyway, 12 months later, they loved my book, said some great things about it, and invited me down to London to sign a contract. And the first thing I had to say was, my name isn't Colm O'Driscoll, it's Kevin Duffy. I'm not Irish, I'm from Manchester. But he thought this was hilarious, gave me a huge hug, and the deal was done. Unfortunately, after 12 months, they couldn't sell my book. Nobody wanted humorous books about northern hippies moving into a post-industrial town in 1969. So that was that. I decided then, after 2 years, to get the rights back. Got the rights back from the book. I was moping around the house, basically, and Heather, who's my wife, said, do something about it. Don't be such a mad ass. So we remortgaged the house and started Blue Moose Books in 2006. We published my book, which was Ant Hills and Stars, and a book by a Canadian writer, The Bridge Between, by Nathan Vanek. And we made enough money from those two books to continue. And here we are, 10 years later, publishing. Our books have won many awards, been sold to Hollywood, to ITV, to Channel 4, been published in 14 different languages. We're now sold in 43 countries around the world, and we're just going from strength to strength. And we published the next book is Tainted Love by Anna Chilvers, which is getting some cracking reviews at the minute. And it's writing, and the landscape plays a huge part in the story, as you've probably already heard. And it's been compared to kind of Wuthering Heights. You get a sense of actually being right in the middle of, on top of the moors, which is brilliant. Great quote, that, comparing it to the Brontes.
What about being based in the north? Do you think it holds you back in any way?
Being in the north, initially when we first started, and I've been in publishing for 20-odd years, worked in London for 5 years, and obviously started here in 2006, based in Hebden Bridge. And with the digital kind of revolution, it's not been a disadvantage. The only problem we had initially was kind of raising our head above the parapet and saying, here we are, we've got some fantastic stories by some brilliant authors. And it was there were issues about getting reviews. I remember one literary editor saying to me, but Kevin, you're not a London publisher, as if geography dictates where you get great stories from. We're very proud to be a northern publisher based in the north, and we are sculpted by our landscape to a certain extent. But we are an international publisher. We're based in the north, but we have international stories. And as I said previously, we sold in 42 countries. Initially, yes, it was an issue, just kind of rattling the sabre to say that we've got some fantastic stories. But there are some brilliant independents based up in the north of England now. And where at one time, say 20, 30 years ago, it may have been a disadvantage being outside of London, but I don't think so anymore. If you look at the Man Booker, which is the biggest literary prize in the world, over the last 5 years, books that have won or books that have been on the long list and short list invariably come from independent publishers based outside London. Because of the economics of the industry, the big publishers don't seem to be taking risks. They're becoming kind of risk averse. It's the smaller independents who are finding the great new writers that some would deem kind of more challenging books that we don't. Because I'm a great believer that stories are transformative. It doesn't matter where you are. We will find readers. We publish the books and we will find readers, which we have done to great success.
Tainted Love, out at the end of May. Let's talk through some of the great reviews.
Thank you. Some Blue Moose books that have won awards. The first book that we sold internationally was actually Anna's first book, Falling Through Clouds, which was published in Russia in 2012 by Centre Polygraph of Moscow. We've subsequently published books in three books in Russia, Bulgaria, Hungary, Turkey, America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. Books are sold all over the world now. Our most recent award-winning book was Beastings by Benjamin Myers, who won the £10,000 Portico Book Prize in October 2015. His previous title, Pig Iron, won the inaugural Gordon Byrne Prize in 2013. And Nod by Adrian Barnes was shortlisted for the Arthur C. Clarke Award, which is the biggest sci-fi award in Europe. King Crow by Michael Stewart won the Guardians Not the Booker Prize in 2011. And in 2012 was picked to be a World Book Night book. Our other best-selling books include Gabriel's Angel, Pig Iron, Beastings, King Crow, Nod, all the books that I've previously said. And we've also sold books to Hollywood. Nod sold to 20th Century Fox, and Stop, Don't Read This by Leonora Rustamova sold to Channel 4. Rustamova, should I say.
Okay, from chapter 25, this is Ali. When I was little, Gran sometimes used to tell me stories about a friend of hers called Meg. She said she was different from other people. She'd been alive for 200 years and she would never die. She had been all over the world and seen all sorts of things. She was alive at the same time as Florence Nightingale and Mary Seacole and all those other people you learn about at school. She was alive before the light bulb was invented and when the first man landed on the moon, though Gran was alive for that as well. I asked my mum if she knew Meg, and Mum said Gran was making it up. Nobody lived that long. Could you imagine how old and decrepit she would be? But Gran said Meg never got any older. She stayed the same, and she always would. After a while, I kind of came round to Mum's way of thinking. I didn't mind. I liked Gran's stories, and I thought she'd made Meg up for me to make me interested in history and as something to share. So I always went along with her and pretended she really existed. Then one day, I walked into Gran's house and there was this woman standing in the kitchen, leaning against the worktop. She was the most beautiful person I'd ever seen. She had blonde hair and she was smiling. She wasn't like anyone else, and I knew straight away that she must be Meg. I couldn't stop staring at her. Gran walked in from the other room and said, "Oh, Ali, there you are." But I didn't look at her and I didn't speak. It was like sipping at a drink of nectar, something perfect and sweet. Meg laughed. "I think she takes after you, Francis," she said. I could see Gran from the corner of my eye, looking from one of us to the other. "Ali," she said quite sharply. Meg was wearing a cream-coloured dress which had no sleeves and ended just above her knees. Her arms and legs were golden brown. Her eyes were clear, and looking at them was like looking at a lake on a hot day. "Ali." Reluctantly, I pulled my gaze away and turned to my gran. "Ali, this is my friend, Meg. Meg, my granddaughter, Ali. Now, Ali, how about you put the kettle on and make us a cup of tea?" Meg was there for a week that time, and I spent as much time as I could at Gran's house. I tried not to stare at her all the time. I did things for her instead. I made her drinks, which she mostly left, and brought her cushions and a stool for her feet, and sat near her waiting in case there was anything else she needed. She was very gracious and never acted as though she was irritated by me. When she was chatting with my gran, I watched her, looking at the curve of her cheek and the lines of her collarbone, but mostly at her eyes, which sometimes looked grey or blue, and once even black. They talked about the past and about people they both knew in Paris. I didn't know Gran had been to Paris, but apparently she had lived there for 2 years when she was younger, and that's where she'd met Meg. When she had gone, I said to Gran, "Meg is the loveliest person in the world." And Gran said, "She's the loveliest person in the world for me. She always will be. But there are others like her. Maybe you'll meet them one day."
Now, for more information on Blue Moose or to order Tainted Love, please visit the Blue Moose website, bluemoosebooks.com.